Welcome to a special presentation of Counterstream Radio, a conversation between Elliot Carter and Phil Lesh. I'm Sarah Cahill. You might not ordinarily connect these two composers because they move in very different musical circles. But as you'll hear during this program, there are some surprising musical connections between them, supported by a friendship of many years. So how did Elliot Carter, one of our most venerable composers of music for the concert hall, and Phil Lesh, best known as the bass player for the Grateful Dead, ever cross paths? Here's Phil Lesh to begin the story.
When I was in junior college, I was lucky enough to have a job at the library, and my job, get this, was to check all the incoming recordings for pops and clicks. So my job was, I got paid for this, it was essentially to sit and listen to music. I had known some of your music before. The Second Quartet, I think, was the first piece.
I never had such a nice job. I had to teach other people how to write it, but I never got another job.
That's much more difficult, believe
me. And it's much more unpleasant in some ways.
Yeah, what do you mean, B-flat? But I think the piece that first really knocked me out was the double concerto. When I heard the double concerto, the original recording with Ralph Kirkpatrick and Charlie Grayson.
Ralph played that very remarkably. Nobody else ever played it that way.
No, I don't think so either. And for some reason, even on the mono recording, the balance was so great. You could hear everything, all the nuances of the two key ones. I wish they'd resurrect that recording. Grateful Dead, my band, formed a foundation to do good works and to give back to the community. And one of the things that we wanted to do was have an artistic arm. And I decided that I would be in charge of that, of promoting new music. Difficult music is the kind of thing that I told. That's how I told it.
I remember we met in San Francisco, and it was after that earthquake and everything was kind of funny.
And we met at your hotel, and I called you. I actually got your phone number and I called you and asked you if we could support because the. The recording of that Bernstein made of the Concerto for Orchestra had been out of print forever. Nobody was going to release it on CD, and I thought, I want to hear because I lost my copy.
Oh, for God.
I lost my copy, and so I said, okay, the first thing that the Rex Foundation is going to do artistically is we're going to fund a recording of Elliot Carter's Concerto for Orchestra. So I can have a copy of it and I can listen to it.
You know, basically. And that's one difficult piece to play. It takes 8 percussion players.
That's right.
And we rehearsed it, and actually Lenny did a very good job. At that time, that Lenny was having problems about the Black Panthers.
Oh, right.
And one of the most remarkable things about that was that I came up with a score, And we start looking at it. And his wife says, somebody's on the phone about the Black Panther. He go away, came back, as if nothing had ever happened. I had 10, I would have said 10 times. And he was and in between, I was having fits, but he was
focused.
He came right back to the same measure and went on.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
Remarkable.
And
man.
He took a lot of trouble over the piece. And in many ways, that record of it has a special character to it.
It does indeed.
That Ollie didn't have, but Ollie had something else.
Exactly. Well, that's the performance that I treasure. Because, I don't know, it has...
It's not
more,
so it's, accurate, but it's lively.
No, but it has drama. It really has the sweep of it. I mean, that piece represents 1968 to me, musically. It really...
Was
I know
it written in 1968?
Yeah, I believe it was.
For
I mean,
God's
it just,
sake,
it just
well, that's
says,
when all those revolutions
yeah,
were happening.
Yeah, the two assassinations.
Well, you know, that's
and,
my yeah. side of the revolution.
That's The Concerto for Orchestra by Elliot Carter, a recording with Leonard Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic. Among Elliot Carter's many honors have been two Pulitzer Prizes and the Gold Medal for Music awarded by the National Institute of Arts and Letters. He was the first composer to be awarded the National Medal of Arts. Aaron Copland called him one of America's most distinguished creative artists in any field. He was born in New York City on December 11th, 1908, and after graduating from the Horace Mann High School in 1926, he majored in literature and languages at Harvard University.
Mr. Carter, why did you not major in music at Harvard?
When I went to Harvard, which was in 1926, the music department was entirely devoted to people who wanted to become organists in churches, so that they were learning how to write, you know, things like hymns, and they could play the. My background at that particular point was entirely in modern music, so the first thing I did in the first lesson, I had a harmony exercise, and I wrote a big dissonant thing that went against it, and the Harvard department was scandalized, and I decided right then and there this was not a place for me. Now, I had gone to Boston, to Harvard, not because of a Harvard, but because of the Boston Symphony, because at that time, Koussevitzky was conducting. He played a great deal of contemporary music in New York when I was living here before I went there. And so the interest to me was to hear the Boston Symphony and get whatever education I could. But the main thing was that he played every Stravinsky work that came out the year after it was written and things like that. So that was what was interesting to me. And it was shocking that there were these stuffy old people at Harvard. Which, I mean, later I was as a visitor, whatever they call it, visiting professor at Harvard. And many, many years later, and they said, I don't like what you say about our department.
Well, make some changes.
But, I mean, now it's all changed entirely. I mean... And let me say one thing about this, is maybe since we've gotten into the subject, is it is my generation that has changed the music teaching all over the United States. I mean, there were music departments that taught organists and conservatives, and then with the coming of this new generation, more and more music departments developed in universities, and they also became wider. Now they the students all know Stockhausen better than Bach.
Phil Lesh was born on March 15, 1940, in Berkeley, California. He started playing violin at a young age and had an early passion for classical music and free jazz. He studied with Luciano Berio at Mills College, where his classmates included Steve Reich and keyboardist Tom Constantin, who later joined his friend Phil for a few years as a member of the Grateful Dead. Lesh wrote notated scores for large ensembles. One of them, Foci from 1963, calls for 123 musicians divided among four orchestras. I asked Phil Lesh how he ended up joining the Grateful Dead in the mid-60s.
I didn't play the bass before I joined the band. I've played violin, I played trumpet, I studied composition, and that was my musical world. And my good friend Jerry saw somehow that what I did would fit with what he was doing, and I wanted to play with him really bad, so he offered me, he said, I want you to learn the bass and play bass in this band. And I said, yeah, baby, I will do that. But the way I play the bass is more indebted to, like, for instance, Renaissance and Baroque counterpoint, really, than it is to jazz or rock bass playing. I like to have a melodic element in the bass line, and I like it to change rhythmically in order to differentiate segments and, you know, bring variety and all that. And as far as the avant-garde influence, that happened mostly on the macro level, in not so much in the playing, but in the conception of some of our recordings and some of the pieces that we worked out, where we'll have different music simultaneously going on together, and that's something that I picked up from your music.
The Grateful Dead in 1969 with their Clementine Jam. You can hear how Phil Lesh's bass has an independent line which is equal with Jerry Garcia's guitar, and they often seem to be playing in several meters at once, which gives the listener the same sense of pleasant disorientation as Elliot Carter's polymetric compositions. As different as these two kinds of music may be, your visceral reaction to them might be very similar. A sensation of coming unglued from chronological time. For both men, that fascination with complex meters can be traced back to Charles Ives. The multiple layering and polyrhythms pioneered by Ives inspired the 16-year-old Elliot Carter, and three decades later and across the country, also inspired the 17-year-old Phil Lesh.
I got to know Charles Ives personally when I was in high school. I had a teacher that knew him, a music teacher, and he took a number of us down to meet Ives, who lived near Gramercy Square down here. And I always remember the Sunday afternoon when Ives gave me a lecture about Stravinsky, and he said, you just can't write some music that repeats itself so much. And he played, not from score, but from memory, the opening of The Firebird, which goes da-da-da-da, pa-pa-pi-da-da, like that. And so came to know him. He gave me a copy of the Concord Sonata, which had just been printed, and also his 114 songs, which have inscriptions that he wrote out to me at that time. He was very nice, very encouraging, and very interested in his music. The thing is that when my father found out that I was a composer, he stopped buying insurance from him. But that. When I visited him just before I went to study in Paris, I told him I was going to study with Nadia Boulanger. He disapproved violently of that. And he took me out in the woods and said, you know, there's these other things around that you'll never get in Paris. And it was really very touching, quite wonderful.
So lovely.
Was he talking about the landscape? Was he talking about nature?
Well, you know, it was a kind of mystic vision.
Yeah, spiritual. It was
of,
a spiritual.
No, of nature as being
the real
sort
teacher.
Of
yeah.
An alive thing that fed things into us. He encouraged me to be a composer. I wrote a nonsensical little piece, and he thought it was interesting that I showed promise, and he was the one who really encouraged me to be a composer long ago. And then he couldn't write any more music after around 1925, and I decided that he was a man who was not going to live very much longer, and here were all these scores which he deposited, actually, in the American Music Center. And I had looked through a lot of them, and I decided that some of them were very hard to read. He had written things, and he would write something on top of the other, and there were scribbles and no words in the core. And I thought, well, it'd be wonderful if we got him to really help make his scores more possible to perform, because they were, you couldn't perform them the way they were. And then Henry Cowell and Lou Harrison and I worked on this for a while. And then I finally found it so depressing, I couldn't go on with it. I mean, there were these things that were, what would happen is that these other people would write out something, that, which maybe sometimes is not so bad, and then take it to him and say, is this the way, is this what you want? And he would say, yes, he was sick, and he accepted a lot. He was a man that was partly not well recognized, rather disliked by the large music profession, and a certain amount of his music is making fun of the musical situation of his time, sort of parodies of men, nasty parodies, noisy things that go wrong. He was very American, and I appreciate it.
And so did I. That was one of the things that attracted me to Ives, was that messiness.
Yeah.
Yeah, which came through even in the recorded performance, even if the scores had been cleaned up, and you got a sense of that he's kind of like a wild-haired radical.
Yeah.
And I really responded to that myself emotionally. Maybe
well,
I thought
it took me a little time to respond to it.
It also ties in with my other great hero. In another realm of music, a John Coltrane. You and Ives and Coltrane, those are my, you guys are my main men.
You're listening to a special Counterstream Radio presentation of a conversation with Elliot Carter and Phil Lesh. I'm Sarah Cahill. That's Symphony No. 1 by Elliot Carter. Listening to Elliot Carter's music, some people hear a strong relationship to jazz. So it's not surprising to learn that as a young man, he was inspired by American jazz musicians.
I used to go to those nightclubs on 52nd Street.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. Tell me more.
And I heard all the Fats Waller and other people. I love that.
Yeah. Did you hear the bebop guys?
Yeah.
Dizzy and Bird and all those guys?
Yeah.
Didn't Duke Ellington say that he heard jazz in your first symphony?
Yeah, my first symphony was written, I think, around 1941 or something, just before the war. And, you know, this was during the time when Franklin Roosevelt had a WPA group in which people were given jobs. And so one of the jobs in this particular... in my particular world, were musicians out of work, and there was an orchestra of musicians that couldn't get jobs, and they played my symphony down at the Cooper Union, and Duke Ellington was there, and he came up to me and said that he thought that there must have been an influence of jazz in my music, and there was at that time, I think.
In many of your pieces, I hear a kind of swing, and I hear that kind of bop phraseology.
Yeah, I think it comes
deeply
out.
Embedded in there, along with, I have to say, Indian classical music.
Well, of course, the thing that struck me most at that time was the idea that you would have a periodic beat, as you say, and against it, improvisation.
Yes.
Which meant that the improviser did not play on the beat, but off the beat, sometimes no connection with it.
Right.
And that is what gave me the idea of all my music.
Really. Yes,
it still goes on.
That's the bop revolution.
Yeah.
Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and...
The jazz which Carter heard intrigued him because of its new rhythmic possibilities. Later in his life, he developed the concept of metric modulation, through which one meter transforms imperceptibly into another, often with that sense of swing that Phil Lesh mentioned. Here's a good example from Carter's String Quartet No. 1, a recording with the Pacifica Quartet. Feel you use metrical modulation in
yes,
work
we definitely today? Do. Yeah. We definitely do, and that's something that it's been part of the fabric of Grateful Dead music and everything I've done afterwards since the beginning. It usually has to do with what is it called? Threes and twos, hemiola. We'll take our 4/4 beat with eight eighth notes, and we'll take three of those eighth notes and three of those eighth notes, and then overlap the next bar another three, and all of a sudden we're in 12/8. Or conversely, we're going rum pa da 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 dum pa da da da, and so then we're going boom boom boom. We're in 4/4.
Thank you.
thinking about the complex rhythmic procedures in their music, it's fascinating to realize that Elliot Carter and Phil Lesh both began their careers with a foundation of physical movement and dance. In the 1930s, Carter was music director of Ballet Caravan, for whom he wrote the ballet score Pocahontas in 1939. 3 decades later, ecstatic crowds were dancing to whatever complicated rhythms the Grateful Dead chose to play. I asked Mr. Carter if he sees images of particular kinds of movement as he composes.
I see musical movement in my compositions. Movements that are around us now are very different from the ones that classical music, older classical music had. I mean, people don't march. They don't have horses making clump, clump, clump. And while we have airplanes that fly in the air, we have air trains, we have automobiles, things that don't go, well, you know, one step at a time.
Very periodic.
And as a result, this conception is something that, while I haven't intended to put it in the music, I see that it's there.
It's kind of the difference between periodic and flowing. Because in a car, you'll have a caesura when the gear is shifted, perhaps, or when you come to a stop. But otherwise, it's all very smooth and very linear, and it's not broken up. And I hear a lot of that in your music.
Oh, sure.
That kind of flow. And in our music, we are constrained in a way by the fact that we started out playing for dancers. And rock music is very, very visceral and very oriented towards that periodic movement. But in my band, I'm constantly trying to subvert that. If we're playing in 4-bar patterns, I'll start my pattern on the fourth bar rather than the first bar, and just move it that way. And I'll do that in the interior of the pattern. Sometimes I'll play the rhythm backwards, or I'll play the negative rhythm as opposed to the original positive rhythm. Going over all these bar lines and these little modules, hopefully that's where the music takes place, is flowing through all that. So I'm really trying to combine the two types of motion.
Yeah, I mean, there is a similarity, I think, between the two of you, the sense of downbeat and upbeat, and that sometimes there's the absence of the downbeat, something left out, you focus instead on...
To my mind, that going back to old music, there's a very clear difference between German music and French music. German music tends to be always on the downbeat, and French music is always concerned with the upbeat. When I studied in Paris, we played a lot of Bach and sang a lot of Bach, and the teacher would always say, well, the upbeat starts right after the downbeat of the previous measure. So then we go, I'm like that. And this is something that is very useful in the kind of music I write, which is sort of polyrhythm, and that is that there's never a sense of the downbeat at all, because the two rhythms constantly chase each other.
In relation to one
another. And sometimes, well, I mean, if they're worked out, they finally come to a downbeat, but I leave it out.
Often, people assume that a composer is someone who writes musical notes on paper, and an improviser makes it up on the spot. But for both Carter and Lesh, those boundaries are not so clearly defined.
Notation is one way to express a musical idea, but it's fixed. The musical idea, with variance for interpretation, will remain the same every time it's played. What we, Grateful Dead, wanted to do, and what I continue to try to do with my band, is to improvise total musical structures, phrasing, bar lengths, harmonic movement, the whole thing, a real musical idea, and we try to create that spontaneously on the spot. The trick is we have to listen more than we play, and so it involves a curious kind of suspension of intent in a way, so that what's happening around you is more important than what it is you're actually playing. And it's kind of like a conceptual leap that musicians have to make. And when it's ideally working right, what you have on the stage is a group mind, and there's no individuals on the stage. When it's really happening, and we are actually doing this, and the music is flowing through us, that I'm not really there. I'm not there at all. That's like nirvana for me.
Well, you know, Stravinsky said that himself, that he was the agent through which music came.
That's right.
That he didn't feel that he was a composer in the sense that he was an individual writing music. He just felt that it came to him and he was writing it down.
I think Mahler said something like that.
There's a lot of that, too.
Yeah. There must be. There must be. Because for me, it's like we're just the pipeline. I read somewhere a really nice phrase about that. In music, we attempt to limit the infinite. So here's this infinite cosmic music, I have to call it. It's which I've always have felt is just playing out there in some other dimension. And when we are worthy, in a sense, we can leave ourselves, our egos behind, and we can tap into that collectively. And maybe it's that each one of us gets the piece that we need to complete the puzzle, or maybe we're all just getting everything and picking and choosing things out of it. It's a very unconscious process, obviously. And the thing about it is that you don't have to work at it, you know, in a certain sense. If you prepare yourself, then it comes or it doesn't.
Point of view, the improvisation is someone acting or performing in front of an audience, and they have to choose what they're going to do in order to present it to the audience. And in my opinion, this is a lack of freedom, because a person with notes can change the notes, he can go back and fix up the beginning. But when you start singing or playing an improvisation, you can never change the first note or the first few notes. It's a continuous thing, and that's it. While a composer can go around and fool, make something middle of there, change something in the middle, and change something at the end. And in some ways, it's more improvisation in composing than in improvising.
That's true. That's true. Although the way that we do it, the music kind of moves in modular blocks, whether there's a chord progression involved or not. So let's say we're playing along and somebody states an idea, okay, and it lasts for four bars, and it's just over a drone. Generally, what in my band what will happen is that once that's stated, it'll be repeated, and then the band having had a chance to hear it will fall in behind, and then variations start creeping in.
Yeah.
Yeah. By repetition, we're able to modify. And frequently, what happens is after we've repeated it three or four times, it's unrecognizable as the original idea.
Yeah.
And something else has been generated from that, perhaps even a chord progression. So I always say to the band, I say, there are no mistakes, number one, only opportunities. And there's another saying in rock music, is that once is a mistake, twice is intentional. Twice is a lick, or, you know, twice is a definitive musical idea. And I also tell the band, when we're really flying and, you know, it's all very free and kind of messy, the downbeat is always where it seems to be for you. If you want to start playing your phrase on the three of the third bar, you go right ahead, because that's one of the things that makes it interesting and generates new ideas is having overlap. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that the patterns are constantly changing. In any case, in relation to what you were saying about improvisation and composing, do you ever get the feeling that you've been able to write out a piece in one single gesture, in one motion, as it were, as if it were an improvisation?
Well, of course, a great deal of my music gives the impression of improvisation. Yeah. That's intentional, but it's also something that has been
refined and
corrected, changed until it finally comes out like that.
Right.
I actually, in my head, I am aware of what I want.
Yes.
But I often find that when I start writing, I don't write things that produce the effect that I want, and I keep rewriting it until it does. It's cool. You do it on the spot. Yeah. I wish I could do that, but I can't.
Discover that you are the song that the morning brings. Your heart has its seasons, its evenings, its songs, and its songs.
Is it for you to work with musicians on your music before performances or recordings?
This is a very complicated problem. This is another one of those problems. In the old days, I used to criticize musicians a great deal and say, you must do this and do that there and play this louder and that softer and so forth. And I found that in the end, what you did was to spoil the vision that the performer had of the piece. I mean, now I'm very much more restricted. I don't say very much to performers unless I see that they are missing certain things that could be more effective musically and make a better impression. And then I try to correct them. But, you know, I usually say, well, maybe you better play it your way. It's right. I mean, this is, we do, in the sense, my field has a kind of improvisation always. I mean, reading the notes is like reading a play, Hamlet, for instance. There are 20 different kinds of ways of doing Hamlet and so on.
Yes.
I was curious about recordings versus concert performances, you know, live performances, and if that kind of electricity of the live performance can come through in recordings for you, and it sounds like it can.
That's a very mysterious thing. I guess, Phil, you have the same problem with your group.
Yes.
That in the end, you don't want a recording that has a lot of wrong notes or a lot of little mistakes, so you go into a studio and play it over until you get all those things filtered out. In the course of that, the danger is that you will lose the spirit of the beginning. I don't want to have anything on a record that's too full of mistakes, or even worse, too full of lacking in any spirit, which is what's more important than the notes, and not more important than all the notes, but just occasionally a few.
Some of them.
And, of course, in my music, it also has made demands on performers that haven't been made in this way and in a previous work, so that I'm concerned much more with the sound of the chords and the sound of the texture, and then how one goes from one thing to another. It takes time for the musician to get accustomed to what's going on. I mean, if one man's playing fast, another one's playing slow and different at different speeds, they have to learn that that's the way it's supposed to be, and not try to correct it, and finally appreciate why it is that way.
Yeah, that was. But I've always noticed in your music also a very strong sense of movement towards a destination. And it's phenomenal to me that you can do that without tonality.
Of course, so that's a very old-fashioned point of view. I do that. I feel that that's very old-fashioned. In composers like Boulez, for instance, the concern of going to a destination is not as intentionally avoided.
Yes. I just heard three movements from Please Alone, Plea in Buffalo. I was there meeting with Nicholas Isherwood, and it struck me that that aesthetic, that floating aesthetic, that non-destinational, non-determinal, non-directional, it just seems so dated, that aesthetic.
Maybe it does. I mean, I think my piece sounds more dated because I do what Brahms did.
I can't hear that.
That's Elliot Carter's Piano Quintet, which he composed at the age of 89, with Ursula Oppens and the Arditi Quartet. Elliot Carter will celebrate his 100th birthday this December, and 2008 may be his busiest year ever. Carnegie Hall has appointed him to its Richard and Barbara Debs Composer's Chair. He has several new commissions, and all over the world, orchestras and chamber ensembles are performing and celebrating his music. When he's not on tour with his band Phil Lesh and Friends, Phil Lesh is composing a new piece for singer Nicholas Isherwood and will be in residence this year at Stanford University. At the end of our joint interview, I asked Elliot Carter and Phil Lesh why they write music, and here is their answer.
I'd have to get a job.
One of the reasons that I write music certainly is because there are a lot of performers that like to play my music and they want more.
That's a very good reason.
And they commission you. Yeah.
They commission, but even if they didn't commission, I'd want to write it. I mean, it's nice to have the money, but it's better to have the piece.
I mean, one thing is you both have had such amazing careers and you've gotten to a point where you could very easily just say, it's time to relax, but you're both, you know, still at it all the time.
Music is relaxing. It is stimulation. It's all of those things. It's real life.
We'd like to thank you for joining us for this special Counterstream Radio presentation. This program was made possible with the support of the Argosy Foundation Contemporary Music Fund and the New York State Music Fund, established by the New York State Attorney General at Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors. The conversation was recorded by Leszek Wojcik. The script was written by Sarah Cahill. The program was edited by Corey Dargle, Molly Sheridan, and Trevor Hunter. A special thank you to David Gantz and to KALW Radio. I'm Sarah Cahill. Thanks for listening.